Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And tonight we have a really good show for you. We have a recorded interview. The interview is
Daniel Esplin.
Yes, and he had a very interesting book. He talks about drugs and how the government is involved in the selling of drugs, the shadow masters. And he also is the author of the true story of the Bilderberg Group. And it's quite an exciting interview. He's an exciting individual, and I hope we get a chance to talk with him again.
Yeah.
I almost feel like there was much more that he had to say and more I wanted to ask him.
Oh, a lot more, yeah.
So he's a very interesting guy. I think you'll enjoy the interview. So you can look forward to that. That'll be in a little bit. But in the meantime, we have some news.
Right. Hang on one second. We will get to that. A whole bunch of good stuff here I want to read.
Now, Leo has collected a lot here. Well, here's something. Kissinger effectively gave the go-ahead for a terrorist attack on U.S. soil in 1976, and this is whatreallyhappened.com, and this is by Jerry Ann Masson, April 11th. According to a declassified documents released by the National Security Archive today, former Secretary of State and longtime Bilderberger, Henry Kissinger, rescinded instructions that would have prevented one of the worst terrorist attacks on U.S. soil before September 11, 2001, from occurring. On September 21, 1976, a car bomb exploded in downtown Washington, D.C., killing former minister of the Chilean Allende government and his assistant, and signifying a major terrorist attack, the likes of which had not been experienced on U.S. soil before. The perpetrators were quickly identified as agents of the Pinochet regime, out to assassinate the figureheads of rival regimes all over the world. As it turns out, the string of attacks known as the Condor Murders was part of a long-time covert operation by several South American intelligence agencies consisting of international assassinations of dissidents and other enemies of fascist dictators. Although initially instructions were sent to U.S. ambassadors in South America to warn military leaders of a series of international murders likely to occur, word came down from the State Department only 5 days before the incident in Washington, stating that the Secretary, Kissinger, had instructed that no further action be taken on this matter. In other words, Kissinger overruled the first instructions, namely to order ambassadors to warn the South American leaders to warn the South American heads of state of likely attacks on their person, replacing it with the instruction to effectively keep silent about them and, by extension, allowing the attack in Washington to move forward unhindered. The Public Record online publication mentions that the instructions effectively ended, and remember, these were from Henry Kissinger, a Bilderberger, efforts by the senior State Department officials to deliver diplomatic demarque approved by Kissinger only 3 weeks earlier to express our deep concern over plans for the assassination of subversives, politicians, and prominent figures, both within the national borders of certain southern countries and abroad, aimed at the heads of state of Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay. The demarche was never delivered, states TPR. According to Peter Kornbluh, author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability, the latest revelation is the missing piece of the historical puzzle on Kissinger's role in the action and inaction of the U.S. government after learning of Condor assassination plots. Indeed, only 2 years after the assassination of former Chilean minister Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., a cable was sent from Robert White, the U.S. ambassador to Paraguay, to Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, detailing a conversation White had with the chief of staff of Paraguay's armed forces. During the exchange, the general had told White that the South American intelligence chiefs involved in Operation Condor kept in touch with one another through a U.S. communications installation in the Panama Zone, which covered all of Latin America. Professor of political science at Long Island University and chief expert on Operation Condor, J. Patrice McSherry, sums up U.S. involvement in the series of assassinations as follows. U.S. military and intelligence officials supported and collaborated with Condor as a secret partner or sponsor. That indeed seems to be the case. Not only does the Anglo-American establishment sponsor terrorist attacks abroad, apparently does not shy away from allowing them to proceed within the U.S. Although it is widely suspected that Operation Condor, as the killing spree has been dubbed, was supervised by U.S. intelligence services, this latest declassified instruction issued by Chris Kissinger provides definitive proof. Ironically, it was on September 11, 2001, that Chilean human rights lawyers filed a criminal case against both Kissinger and Pinochet for their involvement in Operation Condor. The very same day, the worst terrorist attacks in the history of the United States occurred in a likewise suspicious circumstances, to put it mildly, likewise accommodated by the U.S. intelligence community, and likewise pointing to an international conspiracy of geopolitical strategists aiming to subdue sovereign nations before absorbing them into an international syndicate of robber barons, commonly known as the New World Order. Okay.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Has anybody seen The Day of the Condor? There was a movie out on that back in the 70s. It was Robert Redford and The Day of the Condor.
Oh.
That was part of this intelligence assignment. Assassinations, whatever. This one's a little bit alarming. Monsanto is under investigation by 7 U.S. states. This is from organicconsumers.org. At least 7 U.S. state attorneys generals are investigating whether Monsanto Company has abused its market power to lock out competitors and raise prices on seed. Iowa, Illinois, Ohio, Texas, Virginia, and 2 other unidentified states are in a working group to investigate the biotech giant. The states are probing whether Monsanto violated laws by offering rebates to the seed distributors for excluding rival seeds, imposing limits on combining the product with other genetic modifications, or offering cash incentives to switch farmers to more expensive generation of seed varieties. The state investigation adds to pressure on Monsanto. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating the company's marketing practices, and DuPont Company has accused Monsanto of anti-competitive practices in license litigation. Daniel Sokol, a law professor at the University of Florida, expert on antitrust matters, told Bloomberg News that a state-level investigation on top of the federal probe can lengthen the lawsuit and potential settlements and can increase uncertainty and costs for Monsanto. But it must be noted that Obama just appointed the lead lobbyist for Monsanto as the agricultural secretary. Now, can you imagine that kind of crap? What kind of a piece of crap dog, dead dog that Obama really is?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a piece of shit.
He's owned by all these corporations.
By these corporations, yeah. I mean, Monsanto, agricultural secretary. Come on. I mean, it's the absurdity is beyond the belief. But here we go, you know?
He's such a disappointment.
Oh, he's such a sick man. I don't know if you wanted to read this one or one of these.
I was going to read this. Palestinians face more ethnic
cleansing. Yeah.
This is from Press TV. The Israeli military has issued a new ruling that would allow the mass deportation of Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. According to the Israeli media, the new order considers anyone caught in the West Bank who does not hold an Israeli permit to enter and reside in the area, an infiltrator. The order, which is due to come into effect on Tuesday, that was yesterday, would automatically turn tens of thousands of Palestinians into criminal offenders liable to be severely punished. They could face 7 years in prison, would also have to pay the cost of their expulsion from the West Bank, most probably to the Gaza Strip. The first Palestinian likely to be targeted and under the new ruling would be those whose ID cards bear home addresses in the Gaza Strip, and also likely to be targeted are foreign-born spouses of Palestinians. Israeli media outlets have reported that generally that the generality and ambiguity of the ruling language may give it a status to be also applied to Palestinian residents of Jerusalem al-Quds. In addition, the new order puts those found guilty under the sole jurisdiction of Israeli military courts. Meanwhile, 10 Israeli human rights groups have called on Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak to rescind the new ruling. Yeah, right.
So this guy's a piece of work. I mean, you know, they're going to kick everybody out of the West Bank unlawfully.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to do anything about it.
No.
And nobody's going to do anything about it. Even the Palestinians aren't going to do anything about it. You know, so it's like...
They can't.
Well, they can, but they're not going to. So it's like...
What can they do?
Well, there's 10,000 of them there. They could probably...
riot.
Do something. I mean, I would think. Just kick me out of my home and my place and my everything. And just because I'm a Palestinian and you're a goddamn Jew. Come on. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to steal my house, you want to steal my property, and you want to destroy me. Well, I would be destroying them first.
Well, they've tried.
What do you get to lose? You know, what do you get to lose? They're going to kill you anyway, or put you in jail.
They're killing them slowly.
Yeah, they're killing them anyway. So they're going to kill them, kill their families, and then throw them into some prison for 7 years. I would sooner shoot the bastard in the head, you know, and just riot like crazy rather than be thrown out. So what? You know, they're going to shoot you anyway. They're going to kill you anyway. You might as well go out. Nonviolence isn't going to help these guys. You know, violence is going to help them. You know? An onslaught of Iranians and Palestinians and Syrians and everybody else come in there.
The problem,
and just
Leo,
kick the living shit out of that
country. The problem is, Leo, they're all divided. They have no Arab unity.
Yeah, well, all they got to do is blow up one of those countries and they'll be down there like...
Egypt is paid off by the United States.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something. If Iran, if Israel goes to war with Iran, all right, I would be very surprised if Israel didn't start up, and so did the other countries, because, I mean, they're held on by a thread, and we're pushing this Iranian thing way too far, and for no reason, and they just want all kinds of bloodshed out there. That's what they're after. And this is guys. Here's the great morons from our country. What we do, hey, we want nuclear reduction. So what do? We put up, we keep 90 nukes on the Iranian border. As Washington and Moscow sign a new arms reduction treaty, skepticism arises in Turkey as to whether those cuts will include U.S. atomic warheads stored in their country. U.S. President Barack Obama and his Russian counterpart Dmitry Medvedev signed a new strategic arms treaty in Prague on Thursday, which requires both sides to reduce their nuclear arsenals to 1,550, or about one-third below current levels. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has revised the U.S. policy on atomic weapons as part of a new nuclear posture preview that, among other things, is said to be aimed at reducing, the U.S. stockpile. But silence over anticipated U.S. plans to withdraw nuclear bombs deployed in the Kurilik airspace in southern Anatolia was left many speculating on whether Washington has any intentions to remove the weapons at all. Then asked about a possible U.S. move to withdraw its nuclear weapons from 5 European countries, including Turkey, Turkey's defense minister said the Ankara had no information about such plans. and no information has been officially announced. The U.S. was positioned a total of 200 B-61 thermonuclear gravity bombs in Turkey, France, and Netherlands. And Turkey is believed to be hosted 90 bombs at to be hosting 90 bombs at Incirlik base. The possibility of the White House seriously considering a decision to withdraw this B-61 bomb seems unlikely, and it was not consulted. Okay, so it's a crock of shit. I mean, they're going to keep 90 nuclear weapons right there in Turkey, you know? Yeah, right. It's like, come on. They want to be... Doesn't make sense what they're doing. David, this one here, evidence that depleted uranium is intended as a weapon of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read that, or did you want to...
Sure.
Go right there? Feel like it?
Yeah, I'll read part, and then you can read
okay.
part, because it's kind of long.
Okay.
David Roskam reports, now that the horrors of depleted uranium are being revealed to the world, we can expect apologists to begin moving into the next phase of damage control within the coming months. It will likely be claimed that the depopulation of much of the Middle East was an unfortunate result of depleted uranium that the Pentagon used because it was not aware of the health effects it would have. This article is meant to demonstrate why this is not the case. The radioactive waste is intentionally used to depopulate and economically cripple the nations that the United States government declared war on. A declassified memorandum from 1943 explains how radioactive materials can be used as gas warfare instruments. It mentions that as a gas warfare instrument, the material would be ground into particles of microscopic size to form dust and smoke and distributed by a ground fire projectile, land vehicles, or aerial bombs. In this form, it would be inhaled by personnel. The amount necessary to cause death to a person inhaling the material is extremely small. It has been estimated that 1/1,000,000th of a gram accumulating in a person's body would be fatal. There are no known methods of treatment for such a casualty. Of course, depleted uranium fits this description, according to the Pentagon, upon hitting its target. 70% of the uranium vaporizes and turns into microscopic particles that enter its victim's body. More than 50% of depleted uranium particles found in veterans are smaller than 1.5 something. I can't read it, but they're teeny, microscopic. Another document from 1948 shows that the plan evolved and began resembling what we now know as depleted uranium. The United States began looking for ways to weaponize radioactive materials. Its top priorities were weapons to contaminate populated or otherwise critical areas for long periods of time. Munitions combining high explosives with radioactive material to accomplish physical damage and radioactive contamination simultaneously, air and on-surface weapons that would spread contamination across an area to be evacuated, thereby rendering it unusable by enemy forces. Again, depleted uranium fits the bill. Depleted uranium is combined with high explosives, causing the radioactive waste to turn into microscopic dust that contaminates an entire area. It can do this for long periods of time. A final point
needs to be made that the United States does not solely use depleted uranium, the least radioactive of the various types of nuclear waste out there. Depleted uranium has to be distinguished from other forms of nuclear waste that contain artificial isotopes produced in nuclear reactors. These products are even more dangerous because they have shorter half-lives and are thus more radioactive than depleted uranium. It appears that the United States only claims it uses depleted uranium as a cover for the various types of radioactive materials it's actually using. Yeah, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the United Nations has found uranium-236, an artificial isotope of uranium, that does not occur naturally at sites targeted by NATO in the Kosovo. This means that what was used was actually the waste product from a nuclear reactor. There is no reason for the United States to resolve to using recycled uranium besides depleted uranium. This is not a case of the U.S. resorting to using the reprocessed nuclear waste, because depleted uranium is becoming scarce. The United States currently stores 480,000 tons of depleted uranium. Other elements that are found in depleted uranium include plutonium, neptunium, and americium. The fact that the United States chooses to use even more dangerous forms of nuclear waste than it has to proves the fact that it lied about the true purpose of depleted uranium. The idea that depleted uranium is used for its high density and self-sharpening properties is simply a cover for its true function as an instrument of genocide. So you can check that out at David Rothscum, davidrothscum.blogspot.com. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So, very interesting. So we've been talking about this for years on our show.
I wasn't aware they were using other types of nuclear waste.
Oh, we've been talking about depleted uranium for forever on this, and nobody gives a damn, you know.
Well,
it makes me sick.
The soldiers are bringing it back, and they're all contaminated.
Yeah, but they're still going over there. Nobody's telling them, and nobody's making it aware. Then they're denying them coverage when they come back, saying, oh, it's not depleted uranium. It's all in your head.
Yeah, you don't have uranium poisoning.
I was going to read this. It's so small. My God, I can't.
I can't see it. I'm sorry. I couldn't even read it yesterday.
I'm going to try to read it here, but.
There must be.
I don't know why. Whenever you pull up these things from British kind of things, it's very hard to. They print so small. Hard to read. This was a good article. Unfortunately, I don't know if I can.
The magnifying glass make
it? No, not really. Not the way I needed it to. Not a good magnifying glass.
Try this. These might help.
Yeah.
Might just be enough for you.
Maybe. Yeah. All right, the accommodationists. Memo to liberals on the White House death warrants. That was kind of interesting, but I don't pass it. It's just too small, folks.
You'd have to go to the website and read it. Maybe you could give him the website.
It's Chris Floyd.com, and you can check it out. It's an article on it. Accommodation is memo to liberals on the White House death warrants, and I really, it's too small to read.
You can read it on the computer. It's just printing it out. It prints out so small.
So, anyway, what else did I have there?
Something else? I don't know what else you had planned. We had a couple of very long articles that we saved for this particular show.
There was one that I wanted to...
But just hold on, folks. We had... Just have to find it here. And we also had some shorter ones, too. Let's see. This is blockade means clothes ordered for Gaza arrived 2 years late in ruined fight. Oh, this was something. This is from the National. The commercial shipments of clothes and shoes from Israel to merchants in Gaza ordered more than 2 years ago began to arrive in the Palestinian territory this week, but local traders warned it is not an indication of the resumption of greater economic ties between the two sides. Nearly 3 years into Israel's economic blockade of the Gaza Strip, 20 shipping containers of clothes and shoes stuck in storage in Israel for the past 2 years under a ban on imports to Gaza arrived in the enclave on Sunday and Tuesday, but were almost completely ruined by damp, merchants said. More boxes of shoes and clothing that have also been in storage for several years will cross into the Gaza over the next 3 months, according to Raif a Palestinian liaison officer with the Hamas-run economic ministry. A number of shipments of clothes and shoes have also entered Gaza by way of the UN aid packages, the Israeli army said. But businessmen in Gaza said they do not expect to be able to sell any of the clothing and recoup their losses. And Rafat Kozinder, one of Gaza's wealthiest import-export traders, says, this is what we adhere to. As businessmen that used to trade with Israel, he continued, the shipments of spoiled goods is an insult to me. Before the outbreak of the second Intifada in 2000, and to a lesser extent during the period of intermittent violence that preceded the blockade, textile manufacturing was a central part of the economy in Gaza. The United States Agency for International Development said in a report. According to the report, on nearly 700 textile factories in Gaza, both large and small, churned out T-shirts, trousers, dress shirts, and even denims for local Israeli and international consumers during the 80s and 90s. Years ago, if you bought a shirt in Israel, it was made in Gaza, said Christopher Nordahl, the Deputy Director of Operations at the United Nations Relief Works Agency in Gaza. The Israeli companies use Gazans for most of their clothing production, and everybody was happy. But Israel sealed the borders with Gaza to all commercial imports and exports after Hamas seized control of the enclave in 2007, crippling the local industry and undermining the territory's traditional manufacturing and merchant classes. Imports that did not make it in before the closure, such as this week's shipment of clothes and shoes, were left stranded in Israel or the West Bank. The owners of the goods were forced to pay storage fees on the items while they waited for the embargo to be lifted. As a result, 96% of Gaza's factories were inoperable, according to the Palestinian Federation of Industries, a private sector organization. Israel's three-week war on Gaza in December 2008 and January 2009 added further woes to the territory's textile and garments industry, which suffered upwards of $2 million in damages during the fighting, according to the United Nations Development Program. Now clothing merchants are barred from bringing in finished goods, rudimentary sewing machines, or even more raw materials to produce their own clothes. So, really kind of...
Yeah, I mean, they're an occupied nation, and it's not...
It's like a prison.
They're destroying these people, and why there's not enough pressure on these countries to back off, I don't know.
Yeah.
Why they can't do it, I just beyond me why we can't do it.
I don't know why we don't support a humane answer to all this.
There's no explanation for that, other than supporting a Zionist warmongering Israel. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's it. And why should we support that crap? I mean, we got enough crap to support. You know, other than supporting that godforsaken nation. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Forget about it. So, anyway.
How are we doing with our...
We're all set. We've got, for those of you who might have just joined us, we've got an interview with Daniel Estulin, writer of The Shadow Masters, and I'll be talking about the conspiracy of the Bilderberg groups and weapons, arms, and all kinds of stuff. And kind of interesting book, Masters of Shadow Masters. But before we go to that, I just want to give a plug for my own book. It was Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril, 364 pages of scorching political and other topics, political and social commentary, and autobiographical account of the last 7 or 8 years, actually, of our radio show and
our odyssey,
and many people and people we've interviewed and the articles we've read and things that have happened to us and places we've gone. So it's a good book. My mother highly approves of it. She's a Republican, and you know, so I suggest that you all do too. But in the and check it out on Amazon.com. You can buy it right there.
And it has a great cover.
Yeah, it was designed by me. And
it's really awesome design.
The title was created by Lila.
Well, it was a divine inspiration. I think it just sort of came to me.
But anyway, we.
But the cover is great. It's a wonderful design, I think.
Yeah.
One of the best covers I've seen on a book of late. Shows great creativity.
Ever. Best cover ever. So you might want to check that out. On actually, there's a picture of it right there on your show page there for the show. And you can go to and then check it out on Amazon.com. And in the meantime, we're going to go away for our interview with Daniel Estulin.
Yeah.
And here we go.
And you might want to get his book, too.
Yeah. It's called Shadow Masters. Check that out on Amazon, too. And it starts right away here.
And at the same time, 93, 94, 95, all the Western airlines were pulling out of Africa because the entire continent was a blaze of wars. Out of 53 countries, 32, you know, were a blaze of regional and local conflicts and wars. And obviously, you know, having your plane shot out of the sky by local tribes was certainly not good for business. And what Victor Boone basically had found is that by about 1995, he and his merry men of pickling Ruski fighters and pilots who lost their jobs when the Soviet Union fell apart. They controlled 90% of Africa's freight business. 90% of the mega monopoly, not even Microsoft had 90% of the world business. And they were transporting everything from ostriches to ostrich eggs to elephants, zebras, giraffes, guns, gladiolas, which they were buying for $2 a piece in South Africa and reselling for $100 a piece in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. You know, and when towards 1997, when the entire continent was more or less at peace and Western companies started coming back, they realized that one man, this Ruski by the name of Victor Boot, controlled the entire, you know, entire continent of almost a billion people. And obviously, if the United States government, if you're, you know, the United Kingdom government, you don't want this guy running the entire continent, especially realizing that Africa has so many, is such a rich continent of natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you want to create conflict between nations by starting regional wars and selling guns and butter to both sides in any conflict, you can't have this guy meddling in the middle of conflicts. And so they came up with this plan put together by the United States government, by corrupt United Nations officials, and several very, very corrupt American journalists led by Douglas Fair, a former correspondent for the Washington Post in Western Africa. And they basically created this boogeyman out of Victor Boot, saying that he alone basically supplied all the guns to all the conflicts around the world. And that, since, has been proven to be absolutely false, not only in my book, which I absolutely and completely take all of it apart, but also by the courts in Thailand and in Belgium. American government showed up in court in the Victor Boot's case with zero evidence, claiming that all their evidence were, you know, hidden in a secure location somewhere in the state of New York. You know, I document how the DEA agent in charge in Bangkok by the name of Derek Odney offered millions of dollars to a former Russian nuclear intelligence officer who at the time was working on the Victor Boot defense. And this Russian nuclear intelligence officer had the brains to record it with his, you know, spy pen. So we have the video and audio recording of the assistant district attorney of the United States by the name of Derek Odney offering the taxpayers' money, you know, as a bribe to a Russian nuclear intelligence officer. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's fairly illegal. We have Boot's co-conspirator allegedly being kidnapped by American government. We have forged documents presented as real documents by the United States government. And it just goes on and on and on. And, of course, the fact is that they show up in court with zero proof. And also, they, you know, the alleged missiles, which Victor Boot was allegedly trying to sell to the FARC, they were nowhere to be found because they simply didn't exist from the very beginning.
And yet he's still in prison, right?
He's in prison fighting extradition. He was arrested on the 6th of March, 2008, and just as he entered Bangkok. And he just passed the 2-year mark in prison. He's fighting extradition. He won the first case in the but the final decision is made by the appeals court because in Thailand, international cases are not tried by the Supreme Court. But just to give you an idea how ridiculous this whole thing is, Victor Boot's co-conspirator is a man by the name of Andrew Smolian, who was arrested with him at the time. Now, if you look at the photographs in my books, and at the time available on television, both Boot and this guy Smolian, they were guarded by 20, I repeat 20, 2-0, commandos each. Both of them were handcuffed, their passports were taken away. Yet the American government version of this guy Smolian escaped a locked-down hotel guarded on the outside perimeter by over 200 special forces. He slipped his 20 men, the commando guard, and somehow with his handcuffs on, made it into a taxi without the taxi driver noticing, made it to the airport without paying the taxi driver, somehow got out of the car without the taxi driver realizing that the man had handcuffs on, made it to the terminal and bought a ticket without a passport to the only place in the world where, if arrested and in prison, he will spend probably about 300 years in the slammer. And when I called the DEA officer in charge of this investigation, a man by the name of Michael Braun, and I said, is this, you know, your version of events? He basically said to me, yeah, this is the American government version that was sticking to it. And I said to him, you know, and you're calling me a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, for real.
So what happened to him? Where did he end up?
Well, we don't know. He's still in prison. And I spent 6 months in Thailand documenting the entire story, and I just came back to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And my book was, as you know, just released in the United States and Canada. And he'll probably be in prison for the next 5-6 months until this case is resolved. It's very difficult to see and to say how it's going to be finally resolved because, again, you know, when the American government was putting this thing together from behind the scenes, they were doing the what-if scenario. The one what-if scenario they certainly didn't count on is me getting on the airplane, going to Thailand, and taking the entire 15 years worth of trying to get this guy apart in my book. So they came up with a, you know, plan, and which is the second indictment. Now he's fighting not just one indictment, but two indictments. And the second indictment is just a pack of lies. Everything from the word go is a lie, from allegedly buying or trying to buy airplanes for American dealers to money laundering, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it's a very interesting case, and just goes to show you how when the United States government when they don't do things right, how easily even America can be taken to task.
Let me ask you this: they're working so hard to create a case against him. Why do you think they're so laissez-faire about you?
Well, what they care about me is the fact that I have a book out, which explains and destroys the entire case. It also shows that one of the leading lights in American journalism, a man by the name of Douglas Fair, who's written a book called Merchant of Death about Victor Boot, has perjured himself twice in front of the United States Congress, where he testified on record and under oath, and everything he said is a lie, and I take it apart. I explain how the United States government has lied, how it has perjured itself. I explain that every document presented as evidence has been faked. I explain how they kidnapped witnesses, tried to buy off witnesses, slander people. And another example is Victor Boot's second lawyer is actually working for the DEA, something which unfortunately I tried to explain to Victor Boot, and he just would not believe me.
Why wouldn't he believe you?
Well, it's difficult because when you're in prison looking out, the prison life and the life of the prisoner becomes your life, and suddenly the outside world becomes a very, very strange place, which is, you know, if you're ever been to prison, I imagine you have not, but, you know, those who are listening and you who might have been in prison at one time, they certainly understand that after a certain period of time you actually pass in prison, the prison life becomes, you know, the outside world, and the outside world becomes some, you know, strange non-entity like the moon.
Right.
It's very difficult for us to understand, but the people I've spoken to in Bangkok who spent time in prison, they've certainly confirmed this, which is why I was not able to get through to Victor and to his defense team on this.
Well, I'm surprised you were able to get your book published.
Well, you know, one of the great things about America, you still have, you know, these hippie publishers who are simply not afraid of the United States government. They look the government in the face and say, go to hell. And this one great man by the name of Chris Milligan out of Oregon, he published my first book on the Bilderberg Group when no one else would touch it. This is a book that has sold over 3.5 million copies worldwide. Think how much money it could have made an American publisher had they actually taken up the task of publishing the book.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it has nothing to do with capitalism. It has to do with suppressing information they simply can't afford out. So this hippie comes along from Oregon and said, hey, you know, I got a publishing company. I do 4 or 5 books a year. I'll take this on. My daddy was a station, you know, branch chief of the CIA in Southeast Asia in the 1960s. I'm not afraid of these people. And so the man gets my book out, and he makes obviously a hell of a lot of money on it. And now he makes, he will make a lot more money on my second book, The Shadow Masters, because they said, hey, the first book went so well, I'm going to publish a second book. So you can get it out, but certainly no big publisher would come anywhere near my books. And if they did, it would certainly be tough to publish it, which is exactly what happened in Denmark. I was paid the biggest advance in the country's history. I'm actually more money than Dan Brown, only not to have my book published by the same company that released the famous Muhammad cartoons, if you remember, back in 2005.
Right. Wow. So that's great. No, that's great. But I wanted to. But that same company was hooked up with the Bilderbergers, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. J.P. Politiken, exactly. You know, when I was looking at the back in 2005, when you remember the Muslim riots all across the world, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I don't know if I'm the only person in the world who actually saw it or asked the right question, but, you know, I don't have a television set, so I was watching this whole thing in a bar in Spain. And, you know, I'm seeing these people from Morocco all the way to Indonesia, which is, if you look at the map of the world, is a pretty big swath of land. You know, we have over 4 million people out there burning Danish flags. And, you know, and everyone was calling them, you know, Osama bin Laden supporters, Al-Qaeda supporters, you know, Muslim terrorists, extremists. And I was looking at this thing, and I was thinking to myself, where the hell did 4 million Muslims dressed in bedsheets and beach slippers get a Danish flag from?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, if you can answer that question, then suddenly the rest of the picture comes into focus. You know, it's if you and I decided to protest something or wanted to get a Danish flag, we might steal one from the Danish embassy. That's probably as far as it would go. Because I don't think at Macy's or anywhere else in America you're going to find, you know, an abundance of Danish flags. Unless, of course, you know, when you buy a Koran, they sell a Danish flag with it. You know, maybe they might have gotten lucky, but I just don't think so. So the point is, somebody somewhere organized this whole thing across half of the world where all these people got out on the street at the same time, which is pretty darn difficult to do, and started burning Danish flags. That's only one part of it. The second part of it is, you have to have cameras there standing at the right place at the right time filming this. So some big fat guy in New York eating pizza, slobbering all over himself, watching this on television, could say, yeah, these guys are crazy. You know, they want to kill us for our freedom.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, that's so true. He's talking about a tremendous orchestrated propaganda move. That's what we're up against constantly, though, everywhere. I mean, the mainstream American media is one monster propaganda machine, you know. There's no question about that in my mind. But you see it everywhere, and now you see this orchestrated. Even like for instance, I don't mean to get off the subject, but even this orchestrated protest in Iran, the student protest. It just seems funny to me that, you know, George Bush 6 months prior to that said that he was going to do everything covertly and overtly to upset Iran. All right. And yet people look at this as a repressive government, and whether or not it is, I don't know. But, you know, coming from all of the propaganda that we have been fed as a country to continue to keep us at war with these countries, it's beginning to rare, not rare, it's beginning to wear out. You know, I think people are starting finally to see it. Do you see that around the world? Do you see
that? Well, you know, first of all, the majority's perception of reality, especially in political arenas not their own, is shrewdly manipulated and imposed upon them by the men behind the curtain, by the Bilderbergers,
right,
by the Shadow Masters. The people in power go out of their way to make sure you're perpetually misled and manipulated. And finally, you know, people who try to create empires do it by manipulating the people they try to conquer. And obviously, emotionally is one of the best ways to do this. Just pull emotional strings. Which is why, you know, you may ask yourself, why is it that CNN, every time there's a conflict, every time there's a bomb goes off somewhere, they just happen to be at the right place at the right time? Might the United States government or the army actually tell them where this bomb was going to go off in the first place? And this is basically how all of the media manipulation works, and needless to say, my advice to all the people who want to actually get away from it and start thinking independently is turn that darn thing off. You know, I don't have a television. I have never had a television in my life. When I was 6 years old living in the Soviet Union, I had a black and white television. I was seeing this talking head at night. And I'd go behind a television set actually looking for this thing. And I couldn't find it. You know, I'd tell myself, well, this is a lie. You know, I'm 43 years old now. I can explain it a little bit better now, but the idea is still the same. That darn thing is a lie. There's nothing there for people to see. It's a boob tube, and every time you put it on, it just hypnotizes you into oblivion. Again, people, they manipulate the way we think, the way we act, and that's what Big Brother is. It's not about cameras watching us. It's about turning the television on and letting it brainwash us.
I wanted to ask you, in this book, as far as how is the, like, where we now see that 95% of all the opium, or all the heroin is being traded out of Afghanistan, covered over by the war over there. But in your book, I mean, who is involved besides our own government, and there's got to be the British government and a number of other, and all these different agencies that are involved in protecting that drug trade.
Where's the money going?
Who's the big profiteers?
Well, the big profiteers, of course, Wall Street, because that money has to wash itself through Wall Street. See, there's almost $1 trillion a year in drug trade a year. That $1 trillion a year is liquid capital. If you think of money, if you think of criminal money, drug money as water, which is thin, it can flow very quickly from point A to point B. And in the world markets, where you apply money is where you control business. You control the markets, you control the banks, you control interest rates. Drug money flows faster. Money that is not criminal money has to go through regulations and banking systems. It has to go through taxation. It is tracked by the IRS. It is tracked by the government. The lawyers follow it. That money moves like molasses. So obviously that money is not good money, especially if time is money. So the quicker something goes from point A to point B, the more money you make. If you remember back in 1996, when the Taliban first took over the country, the very first thing they did was they literally obliterated the entire Annapolis crop. That was their form of a nuclear jihad, as they don't have a nuclear bomb. What they've done, actually, they eliminated $40 billion of cash from the world's markets. About 8 months later, what we had was 1997, you know, the Asian economic tigers were falling like dominoes one after another. That's because it takes 8 months, you know, for the drug money to wash itself into the system. And at the same time as the Asian tigers were falling into oblivion, Wall Street was experiencing a severe cash shortage because, again, what the Taliban had done, they eliminated and wiped out $40 billion of cash from the equation. Now, there's also another level to it. Let me explain to you very quickly how it works. Corporations trading on Wall Street all have stock values that are based upon annual net profits. Shares of stocks are fractions of ownership in companies. They represent equity. That's easy. It is known as price to earnings. And the multiplier effect in stock value is something as much as a factor of 30. In other words, 15 to 1 or 30 to 1. So basically, if you take it as a strictly mathematical relationship, by adding just $1 to the company's year-end results, it would create $30 in stock value. So, you know, if you take a company such as a Citibank or Chase Manhattan Bank or Brown Brothers Harriman, and if they were to have an additional $10 million in net profits based upon the drug trade, the net increase in their company's stock value could be as much as $300 million. And if you take $20 million in net profit based upon the drug trade, that's $600 million. That's one of the reasons you could never eradicate the drug trade ever. Because if you ever eradicated the drug trade or legalized the drug trade, it would destroy literally overnight the entire world economy. It's the worst thing if you're Wall Street or the United States government or any other government for that matter you could possibly do. And again, that drug money in Afghanistan washes itself through Wall Street. And if anyone tells you that they're there to eradicate the drug trade, or pacify the warlords, they're lying to you through their teeth. Because if you actually want to eradicate the drug trade, you don't need to send American troops to die in Afghanistan. You just surround the country and make sure nobody gets out. Of course, if you did that, whatever is left of the American economy and the world economy, for that matter, will be wiped out overnight. And you certainly can't have that if you're the shadow masters or the Bilderbergers.
So this $40 billion that they did, or this $1 trillion, this is all money. How does it get laundered into the mainstream money supply?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
I said, how does this money get laundered into the normal money supply?
Well, actually, there are two methods that banking institutions use to launder money, through private banks and through correspondent banking. Now, private banking caters to extremely wealthy clients, you know, sheiks, etc., requiring minimum deposits of $1 million. Private banks, they're very attractive for money laundering because more than financial advice, they sell confidentiality to dirty money clients. Now, private banks routinely use code names for accounts and establish what's known as concentration accounts, which commingle bank funds with client funds, cutting off paper trails for billions of dollars of wire transfers and setting up offshore private investment corporations in countries with strict secrecy laws, such as the Cayman Islands and the Bahamas. That's just one example. And needless to say, if you ask any lawmaker how all of this is done, you know, they're certainly not going to tell you. And, you know, without the dirty money, the United States economy, external accounts would be totally unsustainable. Living standards would plummet, the dollar would weaken, and the available investment and loan capital would shrink, and needless to say, Washington would not be able to sustain its global empire. So, obviously, you can't have that.
So our whole economy depends
on... The world economy.
The entire world economy depends on the drug trade.
Exactly.
Pretty
money covers part of the United States deficit in its balance of trade. So without that dirty money, the entire economy would collapse onto itself. It would shrivel into nothing.
Now, besides the United States, is this a world problem too?
Well, of course it's a war problem. You know, going back to the Vietnam War, you know, aside from what textbooks tell you about that war and legends, it was actually a fight between secret societies for control of the drug trade. The French lost.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans won. And as soon as they won, the CIA got in and started doing the same thing the French were doing before. Oh, look at Iraq today. You know, when Saddam Hussein was in power, Iraq never had a drug problem, never, ever had a drug problem. You know, today it is the number one problem in the country above the insecurity and the bombs. You know, you wonder where that came from.
This was all eye opening to me, but I wanted to. Could you explain before, with a few minutes that we have left, could you explain a little bit about the Bilderbergs? For a lot of people seem not to understand that. When I first heard about them, probably about 7 or 8 years ago. Through Alex Jones, the works of Alex Jones and others. But how? Explain the Bilderbergs and how. What their agenda is, right?
Well, you know, in the world of international finance. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. There are those who steer the events and those who react to the events. Now, while the latter are often better known, they're greater numbers and seemingly more powerful, true power rests with the former, and again, at the center of this global financial system are the financial oligarchy today represented by the Bilderberg Group. Now, the idea behind each and every Bilderberg meeting is to create the aristocracy of purpose between European and North American elites on the best ways to manage the planet. Now, you hear a lot of talk, especially in the conspiracy circles, about, you know, Bilderberg being a secret society and evil eye. It is not like that at all. Now, what Bilderberg is in a society, there's no conspiracy, even though a lot of people with their infantile fantasies see it as such. And what basically happens is a lot of people simply don't believe that, you know, a few individuals, you know, can tell somebody what to do, which is in fact, of course, nobody tells anybody what to do. It's about the dynamics of social processes that shape the course of history as a movement of evolving ideas and themes over successive generations. It's not about New World Order. It's not about one world government. It is a meeting of people who represent a certain ideology, and that ideology is ideology of money. It's about creating one world company limited corporations that are more powerful than any government on earth. And this is what they're all all about. Now, Bilderbergers, they were founded through the French Synarchist movement, which in itself is a Marxist esoteric secret society going back to about the 1770s. And the Synarchist movement was founded as the oligarchist counterattack on the principles upon which the United States of America was founded. And their final objective is to destroy every nation state on earth, eliminate constitutions, currencies, borders, flags, and create again not one world government, but one world company limited, which is much easier to control than individual countries and people and their constitutions.
Now, a list of the current members, is that published now? Can you get that on the net?
What we do is we get from our sources inside the Bilderberg meeting annual reports and annual attendee lists. And I can tell you pretty much who attends. You know, the old dinosaurs, David Rockefeller has been attending for the past 50 years, since the first Bilderberg meeting. Henry Kissinger is there all the time. Zbigniew Brzezinski. In 2008, Bilderberg is met in Chantilly in May. Hillary Clinton attended and Barack Obama. And American delegates, Bilderberg delegates, told Barack Obama that the presidency was his to lose. And they told Hillary Clinton to stay the heck out of the way and let him win the presidency, which is basically exactly what happened.
Right.
Bill Clinton attended in 1991 when he was just a lowly Arkansas governor earning $35,000 a year. At that meeting, David Rockefeller gave him a master class on the North American Free Trade Agreement. And then he asked Bill Clinton if he would support it if he ever became president. And he said, well, is it important to you, David? And Rockefeller said, yes, it's very important to us. He said, yeah, of course I would support it. And Rockefeller extended his hand and said, thank you, Mr. President. Well, what happened in 1992? And these are, let's say, some of the American celebrities who attended Bilderberg. And, of course, you have all the royal families in Europe attend Bilderberg. The most important CEOs of the world's most powerful corporations attend them, presidents of the leading banking houses. And, of course, they're joined by leading media corporations such as New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, Newsweek, etc., which is, again, one of the reasons why, you know, you may not be seeing me on David Letterman or Oprah Winfrey Show anytime soon.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm very glad you were able to make it onto our show. One last question I had for you, since you brought her name up, is Hillary Clinton. Now, her name has just been suggested as a Supreme Court justice to replace on the Supreme Court. What would you think of her as a Supreme Court justice for our country?
Well, you know, again, the way politics work today, you know, if nobody makes it to the White House unless, you know, they've been bought and paid for and, you know, agreed to all the conditions by the people around the world. And I can say the same thing about the American Supreme Court. Unfortunately, justice is no longer justice. It is justice for the wealthy, for the people around the world. And, you know, Barack Obama wouldn't be allowed anywhere near the White House had he not agreed to all the conditions. And Hillary Clinton will not be allowed anywhere in the Supreme Court unless, again, she agrees, you know, to a certain political line, which she will toe, or she will be destroyed, because again, when media controls the information, when you disagree or disobey, you know, suddenly some information from your past miraculously appears on the television news shows. And again, you know, unfortunately, we've been led to believe that what appears on the nightly news on the front page of the New York Times has to be the truth, because they will laugh at you and at me, you know, about what we talk about, because they will say, you know, if this is true, why aren't you on the cover of the New York Times?
Why aren't you doing a show with
David Letterman? We tried to get on the David Letterman show, and we were told that I wasn't compelling enough. You know, I guess it's more exciting to talk about Janet Jackson's boob than talk about the real events.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When is the next Bilderberg meeting?
Well, it's in my backyard in Spain. I'm very, you know, very grateful to the Bilderbergers for their generosity. You know, finally, you know, they've been paying attention to my complaints, and you know, they decided to hold it in my backyard. So I'm very, very grateful to them.
Oh,
well,
good.
We want to thank you so much. We're gonna let you go here, but we want to thank you so much for being on, and we want to mention that TrineDay.com is your publisher.
I think it's TrineDay.com. TrineDay.net, but anyway, it's TrineDay Press, and the two books, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, which is,
right.
you know, a runaway international bestseller in 79 countries, and my new book, The Shadow Masters, the book that the United States government is absolutely terrified on. And if you ever have me back on again,
we should talk about the
nuclear terrorism, which I also talk about in my book. For example, Oklahoma City was a nuclear explosion, and Timothy McVeigh had as much to do with it as Winnie the Pooh, you know, Aladdin, or Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
we'd be very interested in talking about that, but we truly appreciate the time that you've taken to talk to us in the middle of the night, and I urge our listening audience to purchase your books. They're quite an eye-opener, and thank you very much for doing the work that you do, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me on your show and letting this message spread far and wide.
It's an important one. Thank you, Daniel.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
That was Daniel Estulin talking to us from Spain about Shadow Masters, his new book. And his other book is The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, and I think you'd appreciate that one as well. I intend to get it. I think it'd be very good.
Father Bilderberg.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in that, and this is a good...
They translate into 79 languages.
Yeah, good. Well, people need to know this information. They need to understand. And the one point that he made that I found interesting, and I have to think more about it, he said, the problem is not global government. The problem is not, what did he say? The problem is not global government. The problem is not governance so much, but economic. It's an economic problem. It's a money problem. And that's what we need to look at. The other things are beneath that. When you trace it back, it's always the money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's more like a forming a corporation, a large world corporation.
Yeah, that's what it is. And that's what we're looking at. And again, that was Daniel Estulin, Estulin. His book is called Shadow Masters, and you can.
I bet he has an interesting background himself. He came to Canada. I think his family immigrated there from Russia, and I think his father was an. I'd like to ask him more about his own family. His father was an outspoken person in Russia, and that's why they had to leave, and they had to leave all their possessions and their everything behind. So they were kind of escorted over the border.
Yeah.
And they had to make a new life in Canada, and obviously they did. I think they had some relatives there.
Well, anyway, it's in the book, and it's a fascinating book if you really you want to know about the one world government, you want to know about how they really operate,
and how governments finance. It's interesting. We're all dependent upon drug money.
Yeah, that's a little
scary.
That's news to me. That the entire world economy is
I always suspected.
Support your drug dealer.
I thought they just supported like black ops operations. I didn't know that it was supporting large corporations.
I didn't either. I had
no idea.
But
I remember that England was actively engaged in the opium business.
The East Indian Company was. That was all dope. That was
So it came. It came like once again from the Brits, from England.
Hail to the Britons! So.
They've given us some
wonderful things.
Horrible things.
Wonderful.
But anyway, we wanted to read a little more news. I was just thinking.
Yeah, we just got. That was the end of that interview, and I want to thank you for listening. And that was Daniel Estulin, and his book is called The Shadow Masters. And don't forget, my book is called Naked at the Mic, Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And you can check that out on Amazon, give you a preview up there. And hope you take a look at it, hope you buy it, and I guarantee you won't be disappointed. So good night, and have a pleasant evening. Talk to you tomorrow.